I'm Christopher Lydon. As we were saying, Tip O'Neill was your father's kind of politician. In fact, he knew your father. He called your dad a darlin' and used to ask about the old man's sore back. Part of that darlin' touch was that he couldn't always remember your dad's name, and of course he knew that almost everybody's dad has a sore back. Tip O'Neill from North Cambridge, Massachusetts, became the House Speaker who stood between Ronald Reagan and the smashing of the New Deal. He had also stood up to Lyndon Johnson against the Vietnam War. Among the legends of Irish Democratic politics, he was careful to distinguish himself from James Michael Curley and from the Kennedys, too. All politics is local, was Tip's famous line. Ordinary people, like himself, he would have said, should be able to count on a compassionate government to see that justice is done, that mercy prevails. John Aloysius Farrell's account of Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century is next, as the conversation continues. Audio webcast of this program is brought to you by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting was provided by Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Copious details available at elsa.photo.net. And by Harvey Silverglade, author of The Shadow University. And by filmmaker Errol Morris, whose upcoming series, First Person, will open on the Independent Film Channel on June 19th. Information at errolmorris.com.
Hi. Hello, gentlemen. How are you? How are you, Cecily? Nice to see you.
And you know Bill
Clinton. Sean, I know you. I know your grandmother and your grandfather and all of your eight aunts and uncles.
Everybody, too.
God, you look like a Healy.
Hello, Mr. Speaker.
How you doing, Dallin? What's her name?
I never
Maggie O'Brien or something like that.
I know.
Oh, don't you know her? I think she works for Leggett. But she's been on the Hill for since before I came here. She's an old pal of Billy Smith's.
Tip.
Yes, dear.
Mary Zamparelli.
Mary Zamparelli. My God, Mary. How are you? Gee, I'm delighted to see you. Hello, darling. Come over here. The regazios I love.
Thank you.
Oh, right. From the grandfather all the way down. How do you do?
Pleased to meet
nice
you.
Nice to see you.
We're trying to get our boy into medical school.
Toughest job in the world.
I know. That's why we come to see you.
Tip O'Neill was the man to see for most of his 50 years in politics, the man to see for jobs and favors, for the business of government, or just for the joy of it. No ordinary man went further, it's been said, and very few big men stayed closer to home. Tip O'Neill was infinitely loyal to the voters of his 8th congressional district, Boston, Cambridge, and environs, and he was loyal to the old Democratic traditions of generous Rooseveltian government when it was no longer fashionable. Tip O'Neill won John F. Kennedy's seat in the House in 1952 and became a major player in the Washington of Johnson, Nixon, and Reagan, of Vietnam, Watergate, and the conservative comeback. We're talking about the late, great Tip O'Neill with his biographer, John Farrell. Our phone is 617-450-2923. That's a new number. Try it again. Just plain 617-450-2923. There was a kind of magic in this modest but very forceful guy, Tip O'Neill, and there is magic in Jack Farrell's book about him called Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. Give him a call at 617-450-2923. Jack Farrell, welcome, and all admiration for this wonderful book. I was saying he inherited, or fought for, and claimed James Michael Curley's seat in the House, which had then been John Kennedy's seat, and yet he was so different from both of those men. How do we sort of sort out the cliches that distinguish Tip O'Neill in Irish Democratic politics?
One of his young aides during the Vietnam era was drawn to him because she said that he had been described to her as a mix of Curley and Kennedy. And the difference was is that he came from a working class, lower middle class neighborhood in North Cambridge. But he came from a very civilized background. He was a civil servant. He was the superintendent of sewers, which was an important job, much more important than it sounds, because you had lots of jobs at your disposal. His brother went to Holy Cross and to Harvard Law School, which was not the usual path for Irish American kids in those days. His sister was the first female principal in the Cambridge Public Schools. And he went to Boston College at a time when only one in four Americans were going to college. So he always had a little bit of, and he probably would spin in his grave to hear me say this, but he had the little bit of a taint of the former the sort of a freshness, of a newness, of the new educated generation that moved, took a step past the Irish Americans like Curley. Although, obviously, he was never in with the rich businessmen like Joseph Kennedy or their sons, John F. Kennedy and Bobby.
In your book is threaded with sort of alliances and wars with Curley and then with the Kennedys. He was with Mike Neville, the mayor of Cambridge, in that 46 race that sort of launched JFK. Didn't much like Bobby. I suspect he didn't ever develop a taste for Joe Kennedy. Kept his distance. What was that all about?
It was one of the crosses he had to bear throughout his career, was that here was this rich, dashing family with the war hero who came back and just sort of declared that the 8th District was theirs. Tip, as you said, was with Neville because he thought you had to pay your dues. He thought you had to work your way up the ladder. You went to the State House, you did that for a while, then you went to Congress, and someday if you stayed and lived long enough, you got to be John McCormick. So he was of a different tradition. He was very conflicted, however, because John F. Kennedy was the first Catholic elected president, and he saw the potential of the Kennedys and what they could do for him and his constituents, and so he had to love that. But on the other hand, they did treat him rather shabbily over the years, and he had a tremendous amount of resentment.
What was the line with the money? JFK would say, Tip, you keep the checks, I'll take the cash.
It was Tip, as Massachusetts has been doing for generations, sending bright young advance men out to the field, was an advance man in Missouri during the 1960 presidential election. And at a fundraiser in St. Louis, run by August Bush, who was the Budweiser beer and St. Louis Cardinals family. They met in a men's room after the fundraiser was over, and Bush pulled out two wads, and he said, here are the checks, and here's about $12,000 in cash. And JFK said, well, give the checks to Kenny O'Donnell and give the cash to me. And he took the $12,000 and put it in his pocket. And Tip said, gee, you know, it's the same in this business, whether you're running for the Ward Alderman slot or the President of the United States.
Several other things surprised me. He took that Irish thing, sort of the first of our kind to have a job. He was the first Irish Catholic Speaker of the House in Massachusetts. He noticed when Marty Nolan became the first Irish American editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, he noticed that kind of thing.
It's amazing. He said, we finally got that job. And this this was in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So even then, he was still carrying this chip on his shoulder. Yeah.
The other thing about him is there's a Christian, I mean, there was nothing pious about Tip, but there is a kind of Catholic Christian gesture in a lot of his work. When he talks about rendering mercy, I was touched.
I probably,
in a way I didn't expect to be. Go ahead.
I probably skate on the thinnest ice, to confess to you, being a good Catholic myself, or being at least a Catholic myself, when I talk about psychological motivation. But I think that he really had a much rougher childhood than he ever let on and that other people ever knew. His mother died when he was 9 months old. He felt very alone. He felt very guilty. And his father worked 6 days a week. He'd come home Saturday night, and that was the first time he would see his dad. So he always described it as a very hard upbringing. At the same time, it was a very Catholic upbringing. So the feelings of compassion for those down and out that he was feeling from his own experience was being reinforced by going to church, hearing the Sermon on the Mount, talked about at school and at church on Sundays. And together they came and sort of formed this amazing sense of compassion that the guy had.
We want to come back to that. I want to come back to a certain quality of sadness about Tip O'Neill, about that wonderful face. I think he was a happy man. He certainly should have been, but there was an air of tragedy. There was an air of tremendous loneliness about that guy. I also, though, let's just remember the man of All Politics is Local. I want to dip into Nancy Porter's marvelous documentary about Tip O'Neill, which she made just after he became Speaker. I think it was 1977. And it has all sorts of wonderful touches about the man at work. But this is a particular segment of the film at Barry's Corner. They had an annual event in which all the old tads got together and talked. And, of course, the hero was the Speaker, Tip O'Neill.
What was Barry's Corner? What was it all about? If you had a date with a girl, or if you were going out with the gang, if you were going to see the Red Sox or the Braves, you met at Barry's Corner. And the respect that we had for the clergy. and the respect that we had for womanhood. You know, I never heard a fellow from that corner ever make a mean and nasty or snide remark as a woman went by. I look back at it with such pride. This party has grown. I used to, in days gone by, like to say Dominic and Touchy and Russ and John, Hago Harrington and Frank O'Connell. Well, let's see, and Sully and John Tatton and Bob Finney and Johnny Breen and Frank O'Connell and you got me, I'm stuck along the line there now, and Jim Delaney and Jim McGrath and Lefty Quinlan, Porky O'Neill and three of the Harringtons here and Arthur Porges and Jimmy Wills, certainly. And, you know, I can look in every one of you that I can see, the Brogans out there, I can remember Feet, your brother. With every one of them, I can remember a happy incident in my life. I can remember the Sunday crap game after Mass in Nelligan's Barn. You know, it's the little things like that that bring nostalgia to you. And so the years slipped by, and Henry Owens, I can remember Henry, God love you, Henry. I can remember going over the Knights of Columbus Hall the night that you fought that guy from New York, and when he knocked you down, we put the lights out, gave you 20 seconds to get up. We thought he was going to be another Joe Louis. And look at poor Louis owes Uncle Sam $1 million in taxes, and Henry's got five. So that's the way the ball bounces. Henry, we love you.
God love you, Tip. What are you saying, Jack Farrell?
Barry's Corner was one of the amazing institutions of Cambridge. It probably makes absolutely no sense from a transportation point of view, but it was a great grandstand for these kids. And it was a big house with a series of wooden steps, and they would sit on them. And that was actually a pecking order, because if you were 11 years old, you got to hang out at the lamppost about 20 feet away, and then you moved over to the boulder when you were about 12 or 13, and you went down to the lower step when you were 14. And then finally, when you reached the pinnacle of the Barry's Corner gang, you got to sit on the top step.
What was that All Politics is Local all about?
It worked on so many levels. In the beginning, it was what his father told him when he lost his first race, which was for the city council. And he spent too much time in other areas of the district and took for granted his own neighborhood. And there's actually a controversy as to whether his father coined the phrase, as Tip said he did. It may have come from Finley Peter Dunn. But it was probably in common currency in the early part of the century. But on a greater scale, going all the way ahead to as far as Reagan or the Vietnam years, what it meant was that if you could stay in touch with your constituents, you could ride out huge national or statewide trends, that the connections that you made with the people around the corner in the neighborhood, the local people, were what was important. And you even found that in last year's congressional races, where the Democrats thought they might be able to take the House running a national campaign, and the Republicans decided that they would run a local campaign. They took Tip's All Politics is Local dictum, and they went back and cultivated their own, and they survived.
Our guest, John Farrell, has written the biography of Thomas P. O'Neill, Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. It has a lot of the qualities of the man, I must say. I want you to talk, Jack, about Vietnam, because in many, many ways it was Vietnam that gave Tip certain immortality. He broke on the war in the middle, late 60s. It was the difference between a lot of other guys that looked like Tip O'Neill, like Phil Philbin or Harold Donahue. Jimmy Cagney rolled in talcum powder, somebody said. Those kind of old Irish politicians. It was Vietnam that sort of put Tip O'Neill in a different category, and it made his greatness, but he also paid a price. I wish you'd walk us through that. How did he change his mind on the war?
Well, he started out, first of all, he was a very loyal Democrat, and this was John Kennedy's war, and it was Lyndon Johnson's war, and he was going to support his president. Also, because of his church, he was a very fierce anti-communist. When he was growing up, it was very common in the 1930s for the priest to take to the pulpit and talk about the horrible communists and what they were doing in Spain and torturing priests. And so throughout his entire year, throughout his entire career, he had a fierce anti-communist streak in it. And as late as 1965 or 1966, he was still, "I'm supporting the president, I'm supporting my president." And his letters at that time out in the files of his papers in Boston College are magnificent because they really show what his district was feeling and what it was going through as the letters slowly change from, you know, God bless you, Tip, God bless President Johnson, to, gee, you know, my son just graduated from Northeastern. He's the first in my family to graduate from college. We thought it was going to be a wonderful day. I've been taking in sewing for 20 years, so we had the money to pay for the tuition, and now he's going to be drafted, and now he's going to go over to this war. And Tip, we don't know what this war is about. We don't know why we're fighting it, and we don't know how it's going to be won. And it was those kind of letters, I think, that changed his mind. Certainly the Globe was liberal leftist. You had Harvard in your district. You had Brookline in his district. But it was really when his working class constituency changed and began to have these severe doubts and fears about this war that Tip changed as well.
You tell a wonderful story about Millie, his wife, sort of taking the heat at the hairdressers,
yes,
for his switch. But I'm also wondering what his kids, what his own dinner table at home had to do with his turn against the war.
Millie's story is that she went to the hairdresser and the person in the next dryer just started to go at her because of what Tip had done about the war. And this woman had a son who was serving in Vietnam. And finally, Millie said basically what Tip said, which is, you know, all right, he's over there. Do you want him over there fighting for something that you don't know what it's about? And do you want him lost in a meaningless cause? And Tip went through a lot of that as his working class constituents had to catch up to him on the war. Certainly, his kids were a major part of why he changed. They were all of that 60s generation. They had sort of moved their allegiance from North Cambridge to Harvard Square, stylistically at least. And Tip used to describe his living room on Sunday evenings when the kids would all bring their friends home and they'd sit around and they'd talk about the war. And he had, in fact, survived a couple of tough primary challenges in the mid-60s because Tommy O'Neill's son's pals at Boston College had served as the nucleus of his campaign and brought an injection of youth. So a lot of things happened. He was getting a lot of input from a lot of different places.
I was surprised reading your book, Jack, how hard they leaned, how hard Lyndon Johnson leaned, and the military, and even some of the old Kennedy politicians. It was tougher, it seems to me, in hindsight, for an establishment figure like Tip O'Neill to dissent than I remembered and that it would be today, it seems to me.
It was September 67 when he came out against the war, and so McCarthy's campaign was still months away. The famous March on the Pentagon was still a couple of months away, Norman Mailer's Armies of the Night March. There was a referendum taken that November in Cambridge, and the war was supported by, I think, 3-1 or 3-2 margins. So he was definitely an act of political bravery, though he was very sensitive throughout his life about the criticism that he had turned on the war because of the kids at Harvard Square.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. We're talking with Jack Farrell about his biography of Tip O'Neill. 617-450-2923. Bill is calling from St. Johnsburg, New York.
Hello there.
Welcome.
Hello.
Good to hear your voice, man.
Yes. In an earlier lifetime, I used to cover Cambridge politics, and I can remember Tip walking into a room and doing that shtick almost of recognizing every person in there.
How are you, Bill?
But what I always wanted to know, I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at politicians, and most of the time when they're in public, they're at their most fake, you know? They're pretending, and somehow it didn't seem like that with Tip. I wanted some sense of whether or not he really, really did enjoy that sort of interchange with the local, and if so, what it was about him that kept, you know, the sort of blandishments of Washington from becoming the most important part of his life.
Interesting question, Bill. Thank you, Jack Farrell.
Yeah, his daughter Susan told me that she thought the reason that her father and mother had so many kids was that Tip always liked to crowd around. And I think that the loneliness of his childhood really forced him to search for human contact, to have a lot of people around, to be this amazing person. When he was in the state legislature, his friend Leo Deal used to say that he had the imprint of the Ace of Spades on his rear end because he always had a pack of cards in his back pocket and never went home. It was the same thing with the Barry's Corner Gang, with walking the streets of Cambridge. With politicians, it's very hard. Politicians and particularly Hollywood actors are very good at putting on a persona that it's very difficult to pierce. But with Tip, I believe that the friendliness and the warm-heartedness was genuine.
What is your guess as to what his colleagues really thought about him? There's a marvelous line in your book from Richard Bolling, congressman from Missouri, who said he had the one thing that Bolling really cared about in a legislative politician, which was compassion. On the other hand, I was surprised how Nixon hated him, thought he was the embodiment of sort of hack Democratic politics, and Ronald Reagan, too, for all the affection in their photographs, was very wary of Tip O'Neill.
Tip had some of the most interesting interviews I did were with people like Tony Coelho, Dan Rostenkowski, Jim Wright, people who were rivals of Tip's, and they said all these wonderful, warm things, and yet from those conversations came out the idea that they were a little unsure that perhaps he had picked their pocket, that perhaps the great shows of affection had actually been a tool used against them. And I think Reagan was basically the same category. I came to believe that Reagan and O'Neill liked each other enough that they could hurt each other's feelings, which is probably something for two great ideological warriors like that. But they were certainly not great friends, nor were they great personal enemies.
That's interesting. What about Jimmy Carter?
Jimmy,
he said, and Hannibal Jerkin, his right-hand man.
That was probably the poorest fit in politics in that century. Coming into office as Speaker of the House, you're from North Cambridge, and here comes this moralist from Georgia, who's the first, really, the trailblazer of the New Democrats, ready to look at the New Deal through a different light. And you've got to spend your first 4 years. And then Ted Kennedy from home decides he's going to run against this president. And it was a horrible, agonizing 4 years. Maybe been even more painful for Tip than the Reagan years.
Hamilton Jordan was his name. Tip called him Hannibal Jerkin. How did that happen?
They got off on a bad foot right away. At the inaugural gala, which was held at the Kennedy Center, there was a bunch of Hollywood stars would come and sing, and the president came. And Tip usually didn't like that kind of stuff. But now that he was Speaker of the House, Millie came down, the kids came down, they wanted to go together. And they put in the request for tickets very late. And Tip and Millie got good seats, but the rest of the family and good family friends like Eddie Boland were stuck in the rear of the hall. And so Tip called Jordan up and said, you know, those were the lousiest seats. You know, you're trying to send a message. And Jordan said, well, if you don't like the seats, send the money back, or we'll send the money back to you. And Tip uttered a coarse profanity, and the relationship went downhill from there. But part of it was all show. I mean, it was the old guys on the Hill telling this new president, you know, we just dumped a president we didn't like. We just dumped Richard Nixon. Don't go throwing elbows with us. You know, we're going to meet you at 800 Pennsylvania Avenue. We're not going to go all the way down to 1600.
We're talking about Tip O'Neill with the man who's written a marvelous biography, John A. Farrell. The phone's 617-450-2923. Jerry is calling from Burlington, Vermont.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Jerry, welcome.
Nice to hear you back on the air. It's really great.
Thank you, Jerry.
I hope it'll go on forever. I remember a time during Reagan, at the beginning of Reagan, when I guess it was something broadcast from the Senate where they were really treating him with utter contempt. I mean, really overtly laughing at him and so on. I believe he changed that around, but I can't remember how he did it.
When they were treating Tip with utter
yeah,
contempt.
Yeah, really. I mean, just ridiculing him, openly ridiculing him.
One of the things he did was that, and amazing, this is, I think, really the great testament to Tip O'Neill, was that he was this ward politician, and he was a man of the House, a man of the Congress. And all of a sudden in 1981, there was nobody else. Kennedy, Humphrey, Johnson, they were all gone. Roosevelt was long dead. It was just Tip O'Neill representing this entire Democratic tradition. And he had to lift his game, and at the age of 70, he did it. And it's amazing to think that somebody could be that subtle and that smart. He cleaned up his personal appearance. He worked very carefully on his diction. He hired this guy, Chris Matthews, this young baby-faced kid who's now on CNBC at night. And that was the first spinmeister to arrive on Capitol Hill. And they sort of built a O'Neill called a counter-pulpit to the presidency up there. And, of course, there was this journalistic tradition that you had to get the other side. So the reporters would go down and listen to Reagan, and they'd go up to the Hill, and he was the guy that had to speak for the Democratic Party. And the fact that this guy from this from his tradition, with really no great like or aptitude for television, was able to do battle with Reagan on those terms was really quite remarkable.
He'd been the object of spin himself. I mean, I remember that Republican commercial.
Horrible
showed
commercial.
Showed an actor vaguely like, or not so vaguely like, Tip O'Neill, with a big shock of white hair in a sort of government limousine breaking down on the road. They thought they could make hay with Tip, and in a sense they did.
Absolutely. And you know, you can't... Tip was going to be forced into that role by the Republicans, whether he liked it or not, because they took him as a caricature. And so he had the choice of being a caricature and hiding out in the cloakroom and hoping the heat didn't get too bad, or he had the choice of coming out and taking on Reagan, which he did.
How do you score him, Jack, just on the matter of saving the essence of the New Deal? I mean, what were the test fights, and how did he do in the end?
I think you have to go back and say what was in place at that time when the Reagan Revolution occurred and what Reagan wanted to do. Definitely the country was drifting towards a Christian Democrat or Social Democrat type Western European state, or at least the Democratic Party was. And Ronald Reagan came and said, no, we're not going to go in that direction any further. And the country endorsed that in the 1980 elections. So the question was, were you going to draw a line there, or were you going to go back? Were you going to start to dismantle some of the Great Society programs and dismantle some of the New Deal programs? And what Tip did, I think, is that he drew a line that has dominated our politics for the succeeding 21 years. And that was, you know, you're not going to touch Social Security, you're not going to touch the core programs of the New Deal and the Great Society. Okay, we won't go further, may not do health insurance, I may not have the votes or the support in the country to put together a massive public works program anymore. You may even get your tax cut and your defense spending, but in the end, you know, we're not going to go to war in Central America. We're going to draw a line, and the two sides have been basically squared off on that line ever since. Gingrich tried to cross it in 1994-96 by going after Medicare and Medicaid, and Bill Clinton was the one at that time defended the line, and now George W. May be trying it with a charm offensive in Washington, going after Social Security through the kinder, gentler way of privatization.
How would you score the sort of man-to-man contest with Ronald Reagan?
On the surface, Reagan really just swept everything before him. I mean, Reagan was a phenomenal politician. What he did for the country's morale at that time was just amazing. What he did in seeing that an arms buildup could possibly force the Soviet Union to its knees was genius. And on the big picture, you have to call that the Reagan era. You don't call that the O'Neill era. But as far as what we emerged from the 80s with, which is, again, the core programs of the New Deal and the Great Society intact, in the guerrilla warfare, in the back rooms where Tip was best, I think that he drew a line and he stopped the Reagan Revolution cold.
For some reason, the idea of college loans and expanding college loans always seems to me kind of core Tip.
He loved Pell Grants.
Exactly, yep. Exactly. And how much of that survives?
Not only has it survived, but one of the few things that Bill Clinton was able to do in his last couple of years in his office was very quietly expand college opportunity and also health care for children.
We're talking with the biographer, John A. Farrell, about his book on Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. Give us a call at 617-450-2923. We'll be back after a short break. Audio webcast of this program is brought to you by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting was provided by Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Copious details available at elsa.photo.net. And by Harvey Silverglade, author of The Shadow University. And by filmmaker Errol Morris, whose upcoming series, First Person, will open on the Independent Film Channel on June 19th. Information at errolmorris.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. We're talking with John A. Farrell about his book on the late great Speaker of the U.S. House, Thomas P., known as Tip O'Neill. Give us a call at 617-450-2923. This is the man that Tip O'Neill, that is, that Jimmy Breslin called a lovely spring rain of a man. We're speaking about him as a kind of secular saint, Jack. Did he have a big fault?
I think he did. I think he had a he had sort of that Irish dark feelings of inferiority that at times got in his way. He couldn't see the horizon as well as some of his contemporaries. He was very comfortable, he said, and happy to be in the back room. I think that that little dark side probably was his major flaw.
There were Korea Gate and Nursing Home Gate and other little hints of investigation from time to time around Tip O'Neill. Was there ever a serious question about his integrity?
There was a very big serious question about his integrity in the late 1970s, and the FBI launched this secret probe that I found out by doing a Freedom of Information Act request with the Bureau. And they scrubbed him pretty good for about 2 years. And the notion was that he had traded an investment in a psychiatric hospital and for about $100,000 in cash, and had helped that group of investors get federal loans for the project. And he was very thoroughly investigated. In fact, the Bureau outfitted a secret source with a secret wire and tape recorder and sent the person into O'Neill's circle and tried to get evidence for it. And in the end, they came up with nothing. They decided that there was nothing there. And most of his contemporaries that I found agreed with what Tip said. And Tip was very qualified when talking about his own political morality, which is that he said, "I was always true to the standards of my time." He also had this great fear of disgracing the family and disgracing the office and sort of falling into the trap of allowing the Yankees to call him just another Irish-American hack. And I think that worked to keep him honest as well.
At Watergate time, he wasn't yet Speaker, but he was a key Democrat. He said later that Watergate ruined politics. He had a sort of all the obvious distaste for Richard Nixon, but you felt that that kind of sort of morality contest was not his taste.
No, I wouldn't say he was forced into it, because he was majority leader and he obviously saw the support in his caucus for it. But it was interesting that many of the forces that he unleashed in Watergate, an independent counsel's office, a federal prosecutors, a aggressive press, were turned on him in the 1970s. He could see not only from his personal experience as he was being investigated and prodded, but also what it was doing to politics as a whole. And it took an awful lot of the fun out of politics. All of a sudden, the fight got very personal. He didn't like Newt Gingrich because he thought Newt did make it personal, when, in fact, with Tip, supposedly, it was something you stopped at 6 p.m. and then went out and had fun with the guys that you waged war with all day.
All politics is local, he said. All biography, it turns out, is local. There's so much regional history here, Jack, that I had half forgotten. Go back to the post-war period, Massachusetts legislature. He was the first Democratic Speaker, elected in the fall of 48, start of 49. Paul Dever was the governor. That may have been Tip at his most visionary, most liberal. Paul Dever was talking in the late 40s, early 50s about universal health insurance, big public works programs, a kind of little New Deal at the state level. And Tip O'Neill had the votes in the legislature to make it happen. What happened to those visions?
Well, Tip, again, you see Tip in the role of tactician rather than strategist, and he was Dever's right-hand man, and he was very comfortable in that role. An interesting thing about Tip, whether or not it's a convenient memory or a blindness, but in his own memoir, he described the 1948 ballot referendum that helped propel him and the Democrats into power as an abortion question. And in fact, what it was this radical idea that doctors should be able to prescribe to women birth control if their health or their lives were endangered by the idea of another pregnancy, or by another pregnancy. And
well, the
Catholic
Church should be able to sell condoms.
Yes, not even drugstores, doctors, whether they were allowed to prescribe it. It was banned in Massachusetts, and the Planned Parenthood organization tried to get together and get that passed. The church came out in such force. They 2 weeks before the election, they had something like 200,000 school children marching in the streets of Boston in front of Cardinal Cushing, as the dignitaries bowed down, and the priests spoke from the pulpit on Sunday morning before the election. And together with the Truman comeback, this is what propelled the Democrats into power. It's very hard to look back now and say, my God, that was a momentous day. But up till then, there had never been a Democratic speaker of the Massachusetts House.
Propelled really by what would now be called forces of reaction against women in the workplace, because if women worked, God knows they might be practicing birth control.
Tip tells a story. There was a bill that had moved through the House, and what that bill would have done, it would have allowed women to be married and retain their jobs as teachers. And it was against the law, and they were trying to change it, and there was a call from the bishop, and he went out on the floor, and he found the Republican leader, and he said, you know, the archdiocese is against that. We're going to overturn it. And the Republican guy said, I don't want part of that fight. And they did it. They turned it over. And so women couldn't even serve on juries until well into the late 1950s.
There's also, you recount the tong wars with the Lopresti family. In 1952, Mike Lopresti of East Boston was a strong candidate for the JFK seat. Tip O'Neill won, not by a huge margin. Cambridge beat Boston, the Italian wards. But Tip couldn't get far enough, and he couldn't get that part of the district out fast enough. He always felt himself vulnerable to the Italian challenge.
Always.
Which I thought was strange and interesting.
Well, again, it's one of those things that it's hard to realized these days, but the passion between the Italians and the Irish in 1952 was amazing. And I thought of it very often back in November when we had the endless presidential election, because in Boston, the Italian wards, the vote was on machines. The city of Boston had actually installed these newfangled voting machines. And those totals came in very quickly, and they showed that Lopresti had a huge lead, and there was a victory party and a big parade through the north.
Almost a headline, right?
There was a headline, Lopresti wins. And in O'Neill headquarters, it was just gloom and doom. And then all of a sudden, Cambridge, which was on paper ballots, began to be counted, and those totals came in, and all of a sudden, the Lopresti lead was being cut. And I met and talked with one of Lopresti's old lieutenants, and he said, we began to smell a rat, and we went over to Cambridge that night, and there were these little Irish guys sitting around counting the ballots, and they had put pencil leads underneath their fingernails. And they'd pick up a paper ballot, and if the ballot was blank, an undervote, they would mark in O'Neill's name, and if the ballot had a Lopresti vote on it, they would mark in O'Neill's name as well, and they would say, oh, this was obviously a flawed ballot, an overvote, and they would crumple it up and throw it away. So things didn't change very much in the last 50 years. It's just the technology was more at fault than
Florida, ahead of its time.
Yeah.
With the late, great Tip O'Neill, Jack Farrell, his biographer, is our guest. Give him a call at 617-450-2923. Kevin is calling from Cambridge.
Yeah, hi, Chris and Jack.
Hello, Kevin.
Basically, having grown up in the North Cambridge area, very familiar with Tip, you know, during my life, and it was amazing because he was like clockwork on a Saturday, his routine, whether, poking his head in the Star Market or going up to the coffee shop, and he always, even to the end, was true to his roots, that all politics are local, and
he called it his ethnic walk.
Yeah,
and he actually started it.
Be your father, Kevin.
and you know, the thing is, I still can't go by the corner of Orchard and Russell and think of the old house there.
Yep.
But I mean a couple of personal anecdotes with him. When my father died back in the '60s, very quickly, within 2 days of his death, my mother had received a handwritten letter from him. Certainly wasn't a form letter by any means, or written by an aide, because Tip had known my father, and those are things you remember. And then one time I had a problem with the post office, and I caught him, and started talking, and he stopped me cold and says, "I can do pretty much anything with the U.S. government except with the post office."
What did that mean, Jack?
I think probably it was a bureaucracy too big for even his ability to wangle and wheel.
The phone is 617-450-2923. David is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hello, David.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks. I was wondering what his, Tip O'Neill's relationship was with, like, Kissinger and the Federal Reserve in the 70s when they started, like, dealing with China, and how he, what his take was on that.
Those are two big, different questions. First,
yeah.
Kissinger, then the Federal Reserve.
I'd do it the other way around. I don't think that he probably had any idea what the Federal Reserve did. He had great bright aides to tell him what the Fed was up to, and what he basically knew was Republican Federal Reserve Chairman, bad guy; Democratic Federal Reserve Chairman, good guy; Republicans for business, Democrats for the working guy. And that was he had a very limited knowledge of economics. Kissinger was a little bit more complicated. There's a White House tape where Nixon is just launching and ripping into Tip, calling him a no-good, no-holds-barred partisan bastard. And you actually hear Kissinger defending Tip. And Tip and Kissinger had something of a back channel, and they could talk about how things were going in Vietnam. And at a couple of key moments, Tip went to the floor and put partisan aside and spoke out on behalf of the American government, rather as a statesman, told his Democrats to get themselves in line and drop their partisan attacks. And I'm sure that Kissinger was very grateful for that.
David, thank you. The phone is 617-450-2923. Ernie is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Ernie.
Chris, how are you?
Welcome. Excellent.
Welcome back.
Thank you, man.
How are you doing?
Doing great.
Great. Hey, Jack. Welcome. I'm listening by phone. I haven't quite cracked the code yet on the streaming video or streaming audio.
Check ChristopherLydon.org.
Right. I'm there. I haven't quite got there yet, but I'm going to get through it.
Okay.
The thought I had listening was when I broke into the Globe, back in the late '70s. My first story was to interview the former Speaker John McCormick. And, and I did, and that was my first break-in, but then got to know the Speaker, Tip O'Neill, and later got to know Joe Moakley. And I'm just curious, I mean, I sort of my thoughts, but Jack, your thoughts about what it was about those three, and still with Joe, obviously, that made them giants in their own right and very powerful, but also very local, and, people just didn't forget where they came from.
Yeah, I think that with the passing of Joe Moakley, really is a passing of a different kind of politician.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there are still a few places in the country, maybe Chicago, San Francisco, New York, Charlie Rangel, where you have the old kind of street politician. But politics these days is so much about television and money.
Right.
And you look at the rest of the Massachusetts delegation, you find nobody cast the kind of shadow that Tip or Moakley did.
Right.
Senior senator.
I sat at the breakfast the other morning, and the accolades they were pouring out for Joe, and was struck by the notion that those that were pouring those accolades out can't and never could really hold up his end of the deal.
Yeah. It was peculiar delegation. Do you remember when Barney Frank and Gary Studs were the only declared homosexuals in
That's
the
right.
Congress,
and at the same time you had,
and there was the Tip crowd, and somebody referred to the delegation as Sodom and Begara. You're the Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe.
Not the Washington editor.
Okay.
Not the bureau chief.
Tip O'Neill had a charmed relationship with that newspaper, most especially with my old boss Bob Healy, and he may well have had something to do with the Globe's becoming the dominant newspaper in New England. How did that happen?
In the 1950s, again, it's hard to conceive, but the first television station licenses were being given out. And you can imagine now what pots of gold these licenses were, the kind of money that they would make over the years. And the Boston Herald, which was the reigning newspaper in Boston and the reigning Republican newspaper in New England, got a television license. And the Taylors family, who owned the Globe, were convinced that this was given out because the Herald had pulled strings in the Eisenhower administration. And so they sent Bob Healy down to Washington as sort of a half private detective, half investigative reporter to try to determine whether that was true or not. And Healy, with a great deal of help from O'Neill, was able to show that the Herald had pulled strings at the White House and with the Federal Communications Commission. And a long, long court battle ensued. But at the end of that court battle, the Herald lost a television license, and the Globe went on to become the predominant paper in the region. And also,
did Tip own the Globe?
A big liberal paper. The way Bob put it was he did a lot of good for the Globe and did well in the Globe over the years.
The phone is 617-450-2923. Larry is calling from Rapid City, South Dakota.
I'm glad to be listening to you online, sir. Thank you,
Larry,
very much.
I'm thrilled you're listening.
I wonder if you could talk about Senator O'Neill's relationship with George McGovern and the East-West farm-city connection.
Good question.
He did not like the prairie populists too much. He wasn't, on a one-to-one basis, he no doubt liked McGovern, liked Eugene McCarthy, liked their politics, liked Walter Mondale. But there was a moralism there that was sort of also reminded him of Jimmy Carter. And so there could never be quite the total connection that he would have felt with somebody from the cities like Chicago. Tip was a very early supporter of farm programs, and he always saw farm programs as a way to unite the Democratic Party that was so splintered ideologically. And in fact, there's a wonderful story in the battle against Reagan where the cotton and sugar congressmen went with Reagan on the big tax votes, and tobacco did not. And lo and behold, 2 or 3 months later, there was a big vote on the ag bill on the House floor, and the leadership went to work on behalf of tobacco and against sugar and cotton. And sugar and cotton lost, and tobacco won. And that was the way all politics was local for the North Carolina delegation.
That's very interesting. You say he was wary of the moralism of those prairie guys. On the other hand, Jack, and the more you say, the more you talk, the more I'm reminded of Hubert Humphrey as perhaps the closest counterpart Tip O'Neill had in my memory of kind of modern American politics. The joy of it, the instinct of it, the flawedness of it, God knows, but the kind of irresistibility of those two men and their enthusiasm for a certain kind of generous government.
Yeah, well, Tip and Hubert were very much alike, and McGovern, McCarthy, and Mondale were much more of the sort of the strict, self-righteous, anti-war wing of the party. And I think that Humphrey's movement on the war probably tracked Tip's. Maybe he was a year or so behind Tip, but they were roughly.
Hubert Humphrey would have been president if he'd had Tip's instinct or courage. If he'd come out against the war in 67 when Tip did.
Publicly. Now, Tip, it's interesting because the Johnson Library has many memos from Hubert to Lyndon Johnson saying, you know, now's the time. We just got the big reelection. Mm-hmm. Let's drop this hot potato now.
Who would you say, you know, including the Rostenkowskis, the Chicago guys, the New York guys, the Prairie guys, who were his closest friends in the end?
Moakley, Silvio Conte from Western Massachusetts. Rosti was more a friendly adversary. They always had a teasing relationship rather than an intensely close one.
Teasing about what?
Oh, they were rivals.
Bad golf, probably.
Yeah, bad golf. Tip loved those golf tournaments, and they used to play tricks on each other. They would go out to these golf tournaments that were sponsored by corporations, and they would have goodie bags with like a shirt and some golf balls and stuff, and they would steal each other's goodie bags. Drive each other nuts. Here were these two guys making $150,000 a year, whatever it was, stealing $20 worth of trinkets from each other.
We're talking about Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century with the biographer John Aloysius Farrell. The phone's 450-2923, 617-450-2923. Larry is calling from Ogdensburg, New York. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. It was nice to see you up in our North Woods.
It was good to be there. Potsdam and all that.
I grew up with a Boston Irish Catholic father from the era of No Irish Need Apply. And so people like Tip were always held up with great regard and as an example of how we should take care of each other kind of thing. And I was wondering, given the climate today, Could there ever be another Tip O'Neill?
Oh, I think absolutely. One of the reasons I wrote this book was to tell my kids and their generation that politics is an honorable profession, that you can do great things for your neighbors and for your fellow Americans, and that you can have fun doing it. And I don't think it's going to be too long before somebody stumbles across that again.
Deal with the question, Jack. It's a tough one, really. Beyond nostalgia, beyond sentimentalism about a wonderful human being, where do we look for that kind of guy, or woman, or anybody in our public life?
Well, you know, he was very good friends with John McCain. And John McCain was a freshman congressman coming from a rabid Republican conservative district in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they hit it off. And I think that, you know, looking back at the last presidential campaign, the one guy that was out there that was sort of calling Americans to a greater sense of duty and obligation, even though, of course, it wasn't philosophically the programs that Tip would have called them for, was McCain. So I think that even in our very recent history, we have had guys who have broke the mold, who aren't trapped sort of in this cycle of TV and money, and can make a difference and strike a chord. That's the most amazing thing.
Mm. Is there a Tip O'Neill in the House today?
Joe Moakley.
I wonder if there's a Tip O'Neill in journalism. Maybe Jack Farrell.
No, I don't make secular saint.
I want to go back to that rather peculiar air about Tip O'Neill. He was a glad-hander, gregarious, great guy in a fight crowd or at a ball game or at a barbecue or at a party, and yet he also had that awareness, not of the dark side, but of difficulty, pain, agony.
Yeah, there was an incident when he was speaker where he needed to get the Black caucus to go along with him on a substitute bill for a Reagan budget bill. And so it was going to be a compromise because they had to get the white Southern conservatives from the Democratic Party to go along as well. And so he met with the Black caucus behind closed doors, and one of them stood up and said, "Well, what do you know about, you know, the prejudice that we have felt and that our constituents have felt?" And he said to them, he said, "Look, you know, I grew up in a broken home. I was shuttled from aunt to aunt. I know what it is to have a tough life as a kid." And so when pressed, that was his explanation for why he had sort of that tragic view of life as well. That just a little bit. I mean, maybe, you know, a third of the amazing personality. I mean, this was a guy who was a genuine, authentic, singular personality in American politics. But he did have that small slice of combination of crepe hanging and inferiority.
Did his own family and his many kids and his marvelous wife make it up?
Make what up?
Well, I mean, I didn't mean fabricate it. I mean, make it up to him.
Oh, make it up to him?
I mean, there seemed to be genuine pleasure there.
There was genuine pleasure there, but you also have to remember it was a different time. I mean, Millie's job was to run the house. The kids' job was to be good political kids. And Tip's job was to go out on weekends and with the boys and to the Barry's Corner gang and then fly to Washington for a week at a time.
It's a wonderful story. And I must say, it's a wonderful life in perspective. I think we're all blessed by this book, Jack. We've all been blessed by Tip O'Neill in our midst. Thank you.
And
Jack Farrell, congratulations on the book.
And thank you for having me back on this special show.
Jack Farrell's book is called Tip O'Neill and the American Century. We'll go out with another clip from Nancy Porter's marvelous documentary film about Mr. Speaker, Tip O'Neill. Thank you, Jack Farrell, and thanks, Tip O'Neill.
Many years ago, I went to a gathering one evening, and my remarks went too good, and I came back and I sat next to Jim Curley. And Curley said to me, you're a young fellow with a great future, and he said, you weren't prepared at all to speak tonight, so I'd like to have you come over Friday morning to my house. And I went over to the house on the Jamaica Way with the Shamrocks, which was so familiar to all of us who used to go by and say, "There's where Jim Curley lives." And he said to me that morning, he said, "I'm going to give you 10 poems. And he said, I want you to remember these 10 poems. These are long life's line. If you walk into a banquet, he said, and you're stuck and you don't know the people, he says, you can always fit one of these in. And one of the poems I really and truly loved. And when I'm with a crowd like my own people, and you are my own, because all the success I have in the world comes from you, I love the poem, and I hope it, I hope I can remember it all. And when round the corner I had a friend in this great city that has no end. The days roll by and the years roll on, and before we know it, a year is gone. I haven't seen my old friend's face, because life is a swift and terrible race. But he knows I like him just as well as in the days when I rang his bell and he rang mine. We were younger then. But now we're tired and busy men, tired of trying to make a name and tired of trying to play the game. Tomorrow comes and tomorrow goes, and the distance between us grows and grows. Around the corner, yet miles away, here's a telegram, sir, Jim died today. And that's what we get and deserve in the end. Around the corner, a vanished friend. And you know, by being together at least once a year, we're not vanished friends. Let's keep the spirit of the old Barry crowd together, together, together. Thanks for everything.
This program was produced by the team of Jake Shapiro, Dan First, Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hakti, and Amy McDonald. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. Audio streaming for the webcast was provided by New England Streaming Media. Thanks also to Nancy Porter, Tom Tiger, Catherine Aitken-Smith, and the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please visit us at www.christopherlydon.org.